Session number 27462, Robin Richards, Reel 1.
Robin Richards, Reel 1. Now, can we start at the beginning, and I'll ask you, can you tell me when you were born and where you were born?
I was born in April 1922 in suburban Claygate in Surrey, in a small semi-detached house which my father was in the busy growing out of. And he bought 3 acres of land just down the road in Cobbleman, Surrey, which must be worth many millions of pounds today. Unfortunately, I don't still own it. He paid £100 for an acre in those days, and he built one house on the 3 acres. That was considered a thing to do in 1922. His father had been a turned farmer in Dorset who really preferred riding to hounds to doing much farm work. And of course, with the gradual fall of farm product prices throughout the 19th century, the end of the century, and through to Edwardian times, there was absolutely no money in farming, with wheat coming in from North America, cheaper and cheaper all the time. And he simply went out of business. And I always had in my youth a vision of my grandfather having lived in a sort of mud hut with a few wisps of thatch on it. But in fact, he lived rather a grand life in a huge flint and brick farmhouse, which you can see to this day, down in the Winterbourne Valley. I think it was a marvellous life. I mean, farmers ate well, but there wasn't any money in it for those who liked to hunt.
So, where were you brought up, and where did you go to school?
Well, my father indeed built this house in Cobham, and we grew up in it. I was sent off to the usual preparatory school in Seaford in Sussex, which I still remember very vividly, but perhaps not particularly to the point. And after that I went to Stowe. And my father, having had a rather poor education, when he went round all the conventional schools like Rugby and Harrow and so on, you know, he found himself being ushered round by the janitor, you know, who had dirty teeth and whiskers up growing out of his ears. My father didn't like this, but when he included Stowe in his rounds, he got to talk with Roxburgh, the headmaster, who had founded the school. It was a great personality, of course, and he simply said, "This is the place for me." Uh-huh.
How did you find Roxburgh as a headmaster?
Roxburgh was a classicist, and he thought that really only classics and histories and the liberal arts mattered at all. The school was founded in 1923, and by 1938 I was the first science sixth former in the school. That means to say that for 15 years, you know, the school had had really no top-level science at all. It was symptomatic that the honours boards where records of scholarships to Oxbridge were recorded included only Oxbridge. Anybody who went to a red brick university, the memory was expunged. And even Roxburgh, when he sent me a nice little letter of congratulation on getting a scholarship to Cambridge, had to write half of it in Latin and put in brackets, "Get a classical friend to interpret," which meant simply that science, you know, and so on was for the birds. What really mattered was the classics. The net result is that I still recite little Latin, bits of Latin poetry to myself in my old age. I find it quite rewarding. The way you keep your head, you keep your memory going is by cramming a Horace Ode in before breakfast.
So you went up to Cambridge in 1939, would that be?
I spent the early part of 1940 as an apprentice in a gasworks, which I found really highly entertaining. I learned a bit about life from the rough and tumble of the workshops in the Tottenham and District Gas Company's Willoughby Lane Works, where there was a lot of bad language and a lot of good workmanship, and I learned how to fit a cast iron piston ring in a steam driven tar pump and rub your nose in the mechanics of a profession. I was wanting to become an engineer, and indeed in 1939 I had entered the Navy as an engineer cadet and was just about accepted. But when the offer of a place at Cambridge came round, I thought, well, this is silly not to accept it. So I did the early part, the first 9 months of 1940, I spent in a gasworks. Then I went and did a 2-year honours degree at Cambridge, which had to be completed in 18 months in those days. You just missed out the first year, and went immediately started on the second year work. And when I finished in the middle of 1942, my brother, who had by that time got himself installed down at Helford with Jerry Helsworth, said, come and join us, I can get you a commission tomorrow, with a green stripe. In those days, RNVR officers who had not got real credentials were obliged to wear a green stripe. They were called special branch officers, and like all the other naval personnel, I was attached to Department of Naval Intelligence, NIDQ, for some reason, whatever that meant.
And what was your brother and Jerry Holdsworth, what were they doing at Helford?
Very briefly, my brother had been minesweeping as an RNVR officer off the coast of Falmouth in 1940. Got blown up on one of the first of the acoustic mines, and during a shore spell, recovering from an injury to his ankle, he'd met a fellow called Bill Lillard, who had known a lot about Brittany during the pre-war period, and between them they hatched up a memorandum for what could be done with the various fishing vessels which had fled to England from Brittany, to get people back into France and generally established two-way traffic. This memorandum bit somebody in Whitehall, and my brother met Jerry Helsworth, and between them they started the Helford base. I think that's about all one needs to know at this stage. It's all recorded, of course, in my brother's book, Secret Flotillas.
Now, what role were you accorded when you arrived at Helford? What was your job personally when you arrived and when you joined the setup there?
The river was then had half a dozen French fishing boats in it, which were used simply as base ships at the time. They had previously been used for operational purposes by Daniel Lomanick and others to establish traffic into the Bay of Biscay. But by by 1942, this was becoming too dangerous, partly because the RAF wished to be free to bomb and attack any fishing boats found west of the longitude of Ushant, because German submarines were surfacing within groups of fishing boats and so escaping the attentions of the RAF. The RAF said to the French fishermen, you've got to stay inside the longitude of Ushant. That meant that it was impossible for a clandestine fishing boat to be found off Ushant without attracting a great deal of adverse enemy attention. By that time, of course, aircraft contact with occupied France had become quite well established, and radio contact, so there was no need anymore for the Biscay operations. The crews, there were some dozens of naval personnel in the river, all recruited from the Lowestoft depot, which were mainly fishermen, were training to do landing operations, particularly for landing on the north coast of Brittany. And the sort of thing that we got up to was trying to develop boats that could land through surf. And if you've got an onshore breeze, 4, 5, 6, getting ashore and getting off again is quite a caper if you're not going to get your boat sunk in the process. We did trials, for example, in the winter of 1942-43 on Praa Sands, round the coast from the Lizard, and we, at that stage, a long landing craft about 23-24 feet long was developed to the designs of Nigel Warrington Smythe, which did in fact prove very effective. It was intended to have 6 oarsmen and would have held anything up to 20 people. In fact, the one operation in which it was used was not for landing through surf, but it was towed behind a gunboat from Dartmouth as a landing boat for picking up some 30 people from the Île Tadiec, which is in the just off the Île Vierge on the Breton coast. That is a great drama because it was ultimately completely successful. It's all very carefully written up in secret flotillas, and there's no need to go into the details here. But that longboat was holding anything up to 15 people at a time. I think they made 2 trips from the gunboat to Île Tadiec to do the pickup, and then came back home with them.
Now, you yourself were involved on dropping supplies, ferrying stores over. Is this right? Are they called the lardering operations?
I was involved in, as you say, one of the lardering operations. The intention was to build up stores of warlike arms in sealed camouflaged containers on the north coast of Brittany. The operation that I was responsible for I think it was known as Carpenter, involved two dories as acting as tugs and towing inflatable boats loaded with a total of about a ton of these containers with arms, explosives and so on. We started from Dartmouth in a Fairmile gunboat. The gunboat dropped anchor just off the Ile Vierge, and we entered the Avevrac River through the Malouine Channel. We landed our stores on one of the islets, tried to bury them, found there was no soil, and simply had to camouflage them as best we could with seaweed and branches and so on. Got barked at by a dog. By the mercy of Providence, managed to find our way back to our gunboat. This, I think, was probably more luck than judgment, because there's a strong cross tide of anything up to 3 or 4 knots which runs at that point on the French coast, and emerging from the from the Malouine Channel to get back to our gunboat, we would have had to row at about 45 degrees to the true course that we wanted to make. Anyway, that operation was more or less successful. But I think it was the last of the lardering operations, because I don't think any more were attempted after that.
Now, Jerry Holdsworth, what do you recall of him, Jerry Holdsworth himself?
Jerry was a buccaneer by a strong character. He had been in SOE from before the war, in the precursor organisation that was being set up in 1939, and he was although he was in naval uniform and had a naval rank, he was very informal in his methods, in the sense that he wanted something, he would use any method that he could to accomplish it. For example, in the first contact operations on the north coast of Cornwall were carried out by Jerry and my brother Brooks in a 36-foot seaplane tender that they had scrounged from somewhere. I think it had probably been used for servicing the flying boats at either in Poole or at Calshot before the war. They were very slow. They did about 15 knots at best, and they were armed with a Tommy gun. And those first operations were to a rendezvous with a fisherman off the Ile de Breja, an operation which was very successful, which is again is completely written up in my brother's book. It was all makeshift. And Jerry Holdsworth gathered round him a number of what you could call quite rough characters. For example, there were a lot of seamen who'd escaped from the Channel Islands and been recruited into the small craft personnel base at Lowestoft. The people who were manning minesweepers and so on. One of the larger than life characters at Helford was a chap called Bunny Newton, who was a red-headed Channel Islander who had been, I think, sort of amateur pirate before the war. Anyway, he certainly made a living by smuggling. And if you wanted something, you simply said to Money, "What about a so-and-so?" And he would say, "Leave it to me," and he'd find it. You know, he would knock it off, the phrase was in those days, and whether he had to pay for it or not. Jerry Holtz was, as I said, collected characters, large and small, all around him, and didn't mind much, too much where they came from. Then, of course, Jerry's main battle was not against the Germans, but was against Captain
Slocum.
Slocum. In MI6, who was supposed to be running all the clandestine maritime traffic between the UK and northern France. And Jerry didn't like that at all. In fact, if he could conduct an operation without consulting Slocum, he did. But of course, it was rather difficult because there were destroyer sweeps up the coast of Brittany at that time, attempting to catch German coastal traffic. And it was quite essential to stay on good terms with the local naval authorities who were based in Plymouth. But Jerry lost the battle with Slocum. Slocum finally achieved his overall control of clandestine traffic in the Channel. And so Jerry more or less stuck two fingers up and said, "Bugger that," and got into Mutin and pushed off to Gibraltar and North Africa to make a new career for himself.
What do you recall about Mutin, the vessel itself? Because it seems to have been around, it seems to have been with SOE for a long time. After
Mutin
that.
Was built about 1930 as a in the shape of a Breton tonneau, but to the standard of a yacht, and it was used for training French naval personnel. She was a beautiful boat, and fortunately is still around. You see, she's being lovingly kept by the French Navy 80 years later. You can still see her on the Breton coast, and she has paid several visits to Helford and to other places in the west of England since the war.
Do you know how Holdsworth managed to get his hands on her? Or do you know how she came to join his flotilla?
Jerry's methods were distinctly unofficial. I just don't know how he swung that one, but you see, nobody else had any real use for a boat like that. She was too slow to be used for operational purposes. Mutin herself was too posh to pass for a genuine working fishing boat. So, you know, she was beautifully finished, and wouldn't have done for the original Biscay traffic. So she was used as a private yacht by Jerry, really.
So he moved to North Africa. When he was squeezed out by Slocum, he moved into North Africa. Is that correct? And how long was it before you followed him? Before you followed him there?
Now, I or a cattle answer. Are you turning the machine off?
Robin Richards, Reel 2.
Jerry and Mutin in Mutin got to Algiers fairly soon after the landings there, and thus began the build-up of the so-called Massingham base near Algiers, which eventually became the main SOE base in North Africa. I don't know what became of Butin herself, but in the middle of 1943, together with seven or eight other personnel from Halford, I came out on an ordinary troop ship to Algiers, and ended up in the Massingham base. There, I managed to be allocated an air sea rescue launch. And at the time, this was after the Sicily and the southern Italian landings, transport to Italy was extremely hard to get hold of. And there were knocking about the Massingham base a number of senior SOE personnel who couldn't get allocated priority to get up to Italy, where of course they, with Jerry Holdsworth, they wanted to get started. I was told to take this air sea rescue craft to Malta and see what happened. And I had as a passenger the head of all the FANYs, Faddies, a lady by the name of Gamel, who had short grey hair and an authoritative manner. And I said to her, "Well, you can come on our boat if you like, as long as you're prepared to stand a watch. And that means that when I get out of my bunk, you all have to get into it, and vice versa. You keep one watch and I'll keep the other one," which she readily agreed to do. That is called sleeping hot bunks in the Navy, I think. So in due course, we arrived in Malta, not worrying about the minefields. We didn't know about things like that, but being a shallow draft boat, we simply rode over the top of them, I think. Commandant Gamel, being of a muscular and masculine appearance, we put a Matelot's hat on her head and lined her up with the rest of the crew on entering Malta. I suppose she must have got on to Italy after that. Anyway, from Malta, I managed to get to Catania, where I picked up a rat-ridden Italian schooner, cargo schooner, which SOE detailed for me to collect loads of abandoned Italian and German arms from places in Tunisia, Bizerta particularly. I think we made two trips.
How large?
Carrying these arms probably to Brindisi, ultimately. But there was rough living. There were rats in the foot of my bunk. We slept on deck. Our drinking water came out of abandoned 50-gallon oil drums, suitably cleansed. But we were able to stop ship and have a bathe in the middle of the day, because that was our only means of keeping reasonably clean while running these very incommodious boats.
What was the storage capability of the Gilfredo?
I dare say Gilfredo would have probably carried about 50 tons. It's a very common type of schooner. They depended on sails for their motive power mostly. There was a single cylinder engine which puttered away sometimes and sometimes didn't. It was mainly for use getting in and out of harbour, but they were sailboats, yes.
Was there ever any danger of attention from the air, from enemy aircraft.
By that stage, no. I don't think we saw any enemy aircraft at all. Our next call was at the Monopoly base, which Jerry had by this time started up. And we managed to exchange Gilfredo for a more modern and more commodious little coaster of about the same size, but with fewer rats on board. We used the new boat, which is called Oreste, as a base ship to live on. And we would go up from the base at Monopoly through to an advanced base in Manfredonia or Vieste, or even round the corner in Ortona, which is north of Monte Gargano, from where we would transfer into whatever craft we were using for the operation in question.